Well, good morning again, and if you will, open up your New Testaments to Matthew, the 15th chapter. We want to think this morning about a lesson about how great is our faith, a passage that comes from a time when Jesus, in fact, the only time it's recorded in Scripture, that he went outside of Israel proper, or Palestine properly, to the region of Tyre and Sidon. Well, it sure is good to see you this morning. I thank the elders for the invitation to come and to be with you this week. I'm so sorry for all of your sicknesses and all of the things that have happened that have kept things from going on as normal. I will certainly miss the potluck at lunch. I'm sure y'all are great cooks, and I'll never get to taste all those fine recipes. And I told somebody one time in a gospel meeting that I intend to write a book someday called Gospel Meeting Recipes, because tell stories about the places, because you eat the best stuff people fix. And most of all, you get to be around their tables. I like that better when you're eating with people and you get to know their lives. There's a great unseen power in this world when we think about all the congregations that are meeting today, all across the Metroplex, but the folks down home, 30 minutes before y'all, but they are still going on. And I think about all the voices lifted in praise at the same time in our part of the world, and all of the hearts that want to follow God's will, and all of that salt and light that's out there in Arlington and Mansfield and Crowley and wherever else you live in this area, and how powerful that is. If we would just think about how much we have to be grateful for, how great our God is, how good this country has been to allow us freedom and the ability and power to preach God's word. So I thank you for the invitation to be here, and I hope that the lessons have helped us as we challenge one another to not be comfortable and to think about the fact that Jesus many, many times made us very uncomfortable. The passage that we're reading from, let's begin reading and then we'll make some comments about it before we begin looking at its major points. Jesus went away from there and withdrew to the district of Tyre and Sidon. And behold, a Canaanite woman from the region came out and was crying, "Have mercy on me, O Lord, Son of David. My daughter is severely oppressed by a demon." But he did not answer her a word. And his disciples came and begged him, saying, "Send her away, for she is crying out after us." He answered, "I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." She came and knelt before him, saying, "Lord, help me." And he answered, "It is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs." She said, "Yea, Lord, yet even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table." Then Jesus answered her, "O woman, great is your faith. Be it done for you as you desire." And her daughter was healed instantly, or as your version must say, from that hour. Very powerful passage, isn't it? One that's very different than anything you often encounter with Jesus, particularly how he treats this lady. He would treat Pharisees that way. He would treat the Sadducees. He would treat the people that should absolutely know better and were behaving in such despicable ways. He had very hard things to say to them. But this woman is seeking his help. She is crying out for a child. I'm going to tell you, the one thing that comes on TV that will get my attention, and I'm liable to and do give to them occasionally, is St. Jude's Hospital. I'm telling you, when you see those little people and all the terrible sufferings they're going through, that tugs at any one of us. What would you do if your daughter was suffering the way this woman's daughter is? Just think, if your child today had cancer and had some rare form of cancer, what lengths would you go to find a cure? Where would you move if you had to move? What would you do? What money would you spend? Countless hours in prayer to God. You can imagine how fervently we would do that. As I said to you, this is the only occasion that Jesus is outside the Jewish territory. But it foreshadows, does it not, the gospel going into all the world, beginning the end of the barriers that had been put up in the Old Testament because of reasons God needed in those cases. She is a woman, I want you to notice, it says at verse 22, a Canaanite. That word is only used two other times, and it's in Acts 7 when Stephen is recounting the history of the Old Testament. Canaanite. The Canaanites were the people that were so horrible that had reached a point where God said the land will vomit them out. Their practices included, for instance, at Jericho, you read one time, and we have found in the archaeological remains, babies that are buried in urns and jars set inside city walls. They were put in there alive as an offering to the gods. The god Molech, that was kind of like a great Buddha figure, and they would roll babies down the arms of this god into a pit of fire that was burning in his belly to offer them to God. You remember times in the Old Testament passages where a king in the Moabites would offer his son on the walls in front of all of Israel. He would kill his own son as an offering to the god Molech. And on their despicable sexual practices and worshiping God, to the point that the prophets say both a father and a son go into the same woman. We can't even possibly imagine how despicable society was. If you think American society is dysfunctional, you imagine how dysfunctional the Canaanites were. Folks, this is the only time the New Testament mentions there was a surviving Canaanite woman. Here's somebody that wasn't wiped out by Israel, who descended from these people. And she comes to him, pleading to him for her help. In verse 22, she had a daughter that was severely demon-possessed. Tack Chumley, in his commentary, says, a badly demonized daughter suffering horrors. The woman cries out to him. The Greek is in imperfect tense. We don't have that tense in English. But it means from the moment that she started crying out to him, she kept crying out to him, to the point that the disciples are just utterly annoyed by it. Get rid of her. They beg him. Get rid of her. Just do what she's asking and get this person out of our presence. But Jesus had much more to teach than that. So persistent was she that he finally grants it. True faith can be found where you least expect it. Rahab the harlot. How likely would any of us think a harlot, period, would be somebody that would have great faith? And then Rahab, who was also a Canaanite, and the first of the cities to be destroyed, at least in Canaanite proper, or Palestine proper in the Old Testament. Naaman the leper, who comes. The church at Corinth in the New Testament. J.C. Ryle, in his expository thoughts on the gospel, says this: it is grace, not place, which makes people believers. Let's think about the points of this passage. First of all, how vital. We talked about ineffective prayer in the class hour. Really, this is a great lesson about effective prayer. How vital to persevere in prayer. I want you to notice what first happens. Jesus, as God listening to her, just ignores her. The first thing he does, verse 23 says, is he answers her not a word. Sometimes my wife's talking to me and I'm watching TV. And I'm hearing somebody chattering, but I have paid no attention to it. And there are ladies in the audience who are just now doing this. Particularly if you have a game on, particularly if it's tonight, you get to watch some of the Cowboy game afterwards, and you say, honey, I'm saying to you, are you listening to me? And they raise their voice, and then finally they get your attention. I mean, when you ignore somebody, that makes people get upset, doesn't it? And for right reasons, because what does that say? I'm just really not interested in what you have to say. I'm not going to pay attention to you. Do you remember when the woman was caught in adultery and they came and the text says they thrust her down in the midst of it? And they told the case and they caught her in the very act of it. What does it say Jesus did? It says he bent and stooped down and wrote with his finger on the ground. And they kept talking to him. Can you imagine what tone of voice they must have used? Can you imagine how mad that made them? That he would just go, I'll do it for this side so y'all can see too. So he would... And people are just talking to him, and he's looking at what he's writing on the ground. You can imagine how upset they would be. Because that just tells you, you don't care one whit about what I'm saying to you. The second thing he does is just as remarkable. He excludes her. When he finally does speak, he says, I was sent only to Israel. So what does that say to a Canaanite woman? I mean, nobody likes to be excluded. I'm going to tell you, That's the big word anymore, isn't it? Inclusion. You want to make everybody feel good. Doesn't matter who they are or what they are. Especially we understand in racial matters that should never be the case, that we would exclude somebody for the basis of the color of somebody's skin. That's horrible. We understand that hopefully better now than we've ever understood it, but we still need to improve. But think about how that would have affected that lady. In effect, he says, you're a Gentile. You don't have one claim on me, lady. I was sent to Israel. And that's period. I was sent to Israel. The ultimate insult. I mean, just the end of the story. You don't have any more claim on me. And then the woman will not let go of it. It says that she pleads, Lord, Son of David, in one of the places. The other, she just says, Lord, help me. Can you imagine anybody that would bring, say, a beaten, battered, bloody body of a little child in their arms, pick up any of these young girls and boys in the audience, and they're in a wreck? That classic scene in Oklahoma when that bombing happened many years ago, and that fireman is carrying that little child out of there. Remember that daycare center that was part of that building? Bloodied body of this little kid that's still alive. I mean, who could be so callous? Who would say, I will not help you. I will not aid you in that. Hobbes writes, one would think that this would have broken Jesus' heart. I believe it did. He still has something to teach. He's setting everything up. And then, folks, to injury, he adds insult. You're a dog. I didn't grow up with my dad's day, but my father said the worst thing that somebody could say to call him when he was in high school was Bull Durham. I don't know anything about that. You probably don't either. Bull Durham was a tobacco. Y'all probably think it was a movie, those of you that came back to the 80s. But it actually was a tobacco. And I've even been in gospel meetings where a lady brought out, they used to have these little gold bulls that they put inside the tobacco pouch, and you would have to roll cigarettes in that day. And that was just like a kind of a caustic thing that if you're going to say something bad about a Durham, you would say that sort of thing. Especially people that weren't going to smoke and act that way. Can you imagine looking at somebody and saying, you're just a dog, you're a swine, you just say the worst possible thing you can think of. Maybe if you're an Aggie, you say you're a Red Raider, at home. No one in his right mind, Jesus is saying, would give food that should go to children of the family to dogs. Because remember, folks, dogs aren't pets back in that day. I realize your text may say little dogs, and she says they eat of the crumbs of the master's table. So I realize that's in there. But dogs were scavengers back in that day. What do you read? They came and licked Lazarus' sores. They ate the body of Jezebel, remember, in the Old Testament. They're not household pets. Lots of the Middle Eastern countries, lots of those places, even over there today, dogs run like packs. They're scavengers. They're not household pets. Some commentaries have said things like, well, maybe Jesus was being playful with this woman, like a friend looking at somebody and saying, you rascal. I'm going to tell you, that takes away from everything in this text. Chumley says in his commentary, the likelihood, however, is that there's not a twinkle in Christ's eye when he calls her that. They sound just as harsh as they read. And then he writes these words, by ignoring, excluding, and insulting this desperate mother, Christ never seemed so un-Christ-like. But I'm going to tell you, this woman, would you given up on step number one, step number two, or step number three? Where would you have said, that's it, I'm done with you? And you just walked away from Jesus. Not this woman. Here's the vitalness of prayer. Here's how important it is to continue to hold on to Him, even when it looks like He's ignoring us, He's insulting us even, He is excluding us. She does not give up. And she takes what He just said and says, yea, Lord, that even the little dogs eat the crumbs that fall from the master's table. And at that, Jesus heals her daughter. I'm going to tell you, she wouldn't take no for an answer. What does God want to know about us? He wants to know if we will pursue Him. If we will pursue Him at all cost. How easily we let discouragement cause us to walk away. That man I told the story about the other night, that his son is killed by a drunk driver, and his answer in his mind is, if God does that to a little 10-year-old boy, I'm not going to follow God. I'm not following a God like that. He walks away from God. Or you've had other disasters happen in your life. Maybe you lost a job that was just the greatest thing on the planet. I've seen that make people become bitter. Or your marriage fell apart. Or just an endless number of things we could talk about. How easily we let discouragement. I'm going to tell you, it's one of Satan's greatest tools to destroy people who otherwise will not commit adultery and lie and cheat and steal and do all the other stuff that the world may be involved in. That's not how God, or Satan rather, often destroys Christians. He destroys Christians by just making us so discouraged we give up. I'm going to tell you, that woman wouldn't give up. Why does the Bible so often tell us things like this? Galatians 6, verse 9, let us not grow weary in doing good. For in due season we will reap if we do not give up. Why does Paul say that? Unless we're so prone to give up. Or something terrible happens and it's like Elijah. We run away from life, as it were. And he runs and runs and runs till he comes to Mount Horeb. And then he's in that cave, you know, and God comes in this huge wind and tears into granite mountains and it just destroys parts of it. And then earthquake and fire, probably lightning, and then a still small voice calls to Elijah and says, Elijah, why are you here? And he says, even I alone am left. I'm just the last person to serve God, Jehovah. And God said, get up and go back. And then he gives him the orders. Anoint so-and-so and even anoint Elisha in your place. I'll tell you, Satan fills our mind with reasons to give up and quit. Let us be sure, as J.C. Ryle said, that no time is so well spent every day as that we spend upon our knees. Jesus hears us, and in His own good time, He will answer His people. Let us never give up on God. That's the last thing that will destroy us for certain. The second point that I want to make to you out of this story is that God must be sought diligently. It goes along with what we've been talking about already. Fervently by us, if He is to be found. How badly do you want God? How badly do I want God? I thought about this when I was studying the Old Testament a while back. Have you ever thought about they had to go three times, every male in Israel had to go three times to Jerusalem in a year. In a year. They had to go for Passover, and then they had to go for Pentecost, and then they had to go for the Feast of Tabernacles. And so 1 month, it's April, March, April, then they have to go back in about June, first part of June, and then they have to go back in what we call October, September, October. Three times. What are you going to do back in that day? You don't catch a bus. You don't have cars that are easy to drive. You have to take the family with you, too, a lot of times. What are you going to do with grandma who's sick? Maybe somebody has to say back because she's too sick. But you're going to pack up the donkey. You've got to load up food on the donkey. It's going to be a few days. If you live up in Issachar and you live up in Zebulun, you live up in Dan in the very north, it's going to take you. It's 250 miles all the way to the end of the Negev. But Jerusalem's going to be a little closer than that. But it's going to take several days for you to get there. And then you're going to have to worship and have the funds and the means to go and offer things at sacrifices at the temple. Maybe you take the animals along with you. Maybe you're going to buy them when you get there. But you're going to pack up enough stuff because the Feast of the Tabernacles is going to last the entire week. And then you've got to do that not just for those feasts, but when you sin against God. You can't go up on that high place that happens to be on the hill above the town where you live, because that's where a lot of your neighbors go. They're starting to do that. But you know that he said, there's only one place where I put my name where you will offer sacrifices to me. It doesn't matter if you live in Zebulun. You know, the guys in Benjamin had it pretty easy. They're only about 5 miles out of Jerusalem. If I sin, that's pretty easy. But if I'm up in Zebulun, I got to pack up the animal. I've got to take the sacrifice with me. We've got to go to Jerusalem. What if you sin the next week after you get back? And then one day, folks, what happens that they quit serving God? The Passover will not be done for centuries of time when Hezekiah and Josiah reinstitute it. That somewhere along the way, you're taking your family along the path that was leading out of the village and you're heading toward Jerusalem, and your little son asks you, said, Daddy, why are the Slackensteins not going why aren't they going to the great feast, Daddy? Well, you say, well, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. And then you pass by more Israelites that aren't going. You know, folks, how tough would we have been in that day? How likely would we have been to say, God, like Jeroboam, this is just too much for you. We'll put you one up in Dan, and we'll have one here at Bethel, and you can come worship. These are the gods that brought you out of Jerusalem. This is just asking too much. How badly do we want God? How much would we seek Him? And folks, when life gets really tough, as it will, when the night is the darkness, only then does the Lord come. You ever thought about how many times that happens? You ever read this passage when Jesus tells them to get in the boat and sail over the Sea of Galilee, and the winds come, and I mean, it's just everything is against them. And then it says to us in chapter 6 and verse 48, that in the verses before, that He starts walking on the water toward them. And He saw that they were making headway painfully, for the wind was against them. And about the fourth watch of the night, in 3 to 6 a.m., they are rowing against the wind and they're making progress very painfully. And at that night, He came to them walking on the sea. But listen to the last passage. He meant to pass them by. You know this is Jesus. He's doing something that is absolutely miraculous, but He's just going to walk by you. He's just going to go on to wherever He was heading. They plead, as the text says, and all of that, the rest of the story that goes on there. But I've always read that passage in the marvel that so often is how we are as God deals with us. It seems as if in our deepest and darkest place, He will pass us by. What's He after? The hour is the darkest for Jacob. What happened? God came in the presence of in the essence of a man and wrestled with Jacob. I'm going to set the story up for you. Jacob comes back to Palestine, heading to it after 20 years of being away. He now has four wives and all these many children, flocks and herds and all this, and men servants, probably maid servants. He's got all this entourage. And then somebody tells him, they hear that Esau's coming with 400 armed men. What would you do if you were Jacob? There's no police force I can go to. Nobody for protection that I can depend on. The last thing I remember Esau saying 20 years before this is, when my dad dies, I'm going to kill him. He stole the birthright from him. I'm going to kill him. Rebecca overheard it, and she had Isaac send him away to her family. He marries in the same family Isaac did, and now they are coming back. So Jacob divides his two families his entourage into two groups, thinking that if Esau attacks one, the other group can. He's doing everything he can do to solve the problem. And then he sends out servants with great numbers of animals, and he says, put a large distance between you. And every time you come to Esau, and Esau says, what's the meaning of this? You say, these are for my lord Esau from your servant Jacob. He's trying to soften him up, isn't he? And then if he made it to where Jacob was, Jacob took the maid servants and their children and put them out front, and then Leah and her children, and then Rachel and Joseph were at the back. And then he crosses over the river Jabbok away from his family. And I don't bet he slept. I know he's not going to sleep, but I bet he wouldn't have slept, do you? To prepare himself for the meeting with Esau. And then out of the darkness, a man attacks you. What are you going to think? If somebody sent like Esau, or maybe somebody else, but they're wrestling. I mean, what do you think? It's wrestling like in a school match? Or for life and death? You think Jacob may have been trying to kill this guy? You think the wrestling that was going on was just the most fervent thing that you can imagine? And then all of a sudden the man, and he goes on and on and on in the night, and then all of a sudden the man touches the socket of his hip and throws it completely out. In fact, a permanent limp apparently that Jacob had the rest of his life, so that the Israelites would not eat the meat that was on the sinew of that bone in an animal from there on. And then the text tells us this. The man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob. He touched, as I said, the socket, and Jacob's hip was put out of joint as he wrestled with him. And then the man says, "Let me go, for the day has broken." This has gone on all night. Jacob said, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." I'm going to tell you, the whole story's changed now, isn't it? Because Jacob has now a fairly good idea of who this is, or at least who God has sent. And he said to him, "What is your name?" And he said, "Jacob." He said, "Your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel," meaning strive, "for you have striven," listen to him, "with God and with men, and have prevailed." You want to have great faith? You want to have great faith? You're going to have to struggle with God and prevail. And so am I. Don't let go of God, no matter how tough it gets. You think of this woman with her daughter. You think of the extent that she had gone in life and the tears she must have shed and the fruitless cure she had sought. She would not let go of Jesus. So the psalmist says to us in 119:71, "It is good for me that I was afflicted, that I might learn your statutes." Where do we learn the most in life? Not at the house of feasting. As Ecclesiastes author says, the house of mourning. I wrote Reagan and John Banks a note a good while ago. Reagan Banks writes some of the most beautiful things. If you've read them, you're friends with her, and you know she has written some of the most beautiful things about the struggle her and her husband have been through, and spiritually what it has taught them. And I urged her, I said, "You've got much work to do. You're one of these ladies that God will use, and you need to work. You need to write. You need to teach." And then I wrote to her, I said, "I think I've learned a little bit, not the extent you have, but I think I've learned a little bit, that we do our best work when we are suffering." I believe that. I don't believe I do my best work when everything goes well. We do our best work spiritually when we suffer, when we are afflicted. Why so often does it happen to us? As J.C. Ryle says, "Without affliction, she might have lived and died in careless ignorance and never seen Jesus at all." So it is with all of us. Lastly, the third point in the lesson is yours. The script, folks, has not been written in stone. We can change the mind of God. Marvel at that. That God would listen to the likes of you and me in our prayers. And though He says one thing that it seems negative to us, and He's not going to do it, but finally He changes his mind. And you think of Moses pleading with God. Calvinism in its purest form declares that all things have been determined by God. If all things have been determined by God, then how can God marvel at great faith? He is greatly moved by great faith. You remember the centurion that said to him, "Don't come to my house. I'm not worthy for you. I'm a man of authority. Just speak the word and my servant will be healed." And when Jesus heard this, Matthew 8 and verse 10, he marveled and said to those who followed him, "Truly I tell you, with no one in Israel I have found such faith." He marveled. He's shocked. He's glad shocked, but he marvels. Folks, if the Calvinist is right, that's just fake. That's just fake. But God can marvel. That should astound us. That he has given us free moral agency and we can excite his heart. We, as poor mortals that we are, can rise up sometimes and show such faith that God goes, "Wow. Now there's something. Look at it." Think of how much we truly do not know him. Close with these words from J.C. Ryle. "Let us mark this well. There's nothing which shows our ignorance so much as our impatience under trouble. Trials are intended to make us think, to wean us from the world, to send us to the Bible, to drive us to our knees. Health is a good thing, but sickness is far better if it leads us to God. Prosperity is a great mercy, but adversity is a greater one if it brings us to Christ. Anything is better than living in carelessness and dying in sin. Better 1,000 times be afflicted like the Canaanitish mother and like her flee to Christ."